From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As the natural gas giant Enron implodes, who profits? Corporate executives cash in their stocks while the workers' pension plans invested in Enron were frozen. Also, Afghan factions meet in Bonn to discuss reconstructing the Afghan government, but are the voices of women being heard? In New York, Women for Afghan Women hold their own conference to secure the future of women. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes bombed a compound southeast of Kandahar, believed to house al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders, said U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who watched the attack live from the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. The Taliban deny that any leaders were hit. Residents of the Afghan border town of Spinboldak said the Taliban were holding on to the town despite heavy U.S. bombing of the area and chaotic surrender talks with thousands of tribal fighters massed nearby. Residents say the Taliban had stepped up security in Spinboldak, which lies on the route between Quetta in western Pakistan and Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, and were also strengthening their presence at the border. Villages inside Pakistani territory were flying Pakistani flags in an effort to prevent U.S. bombing. Pakistan says stray bombs have landed on its territory in recent days. U.S. and United Nations officials raised concerns about a rising tide of lawlessness in northern Afghanistan yesterday afternoon after a Swedish journalist was shot dead. Major media organizations, fearful for the safety of their correspondents, pulled out of the region. The death of the Swedish reporter, Olof Stromberg, the eighth among Western journalists in the past month, is the latest sign of a growing anarchy in parts of Northern Alliance-controlled northern Afghanistan, where robberies, lootings, shootings have become increasingly commonplace. Amnesty International has called for an inquiry into the prison uprising by hundreds of Taliban prisoners of war in Mazar-e-Sharif and the proportionality of the response by the Northern Alliance and U.S. and British military personnel. Upwards of 500 people are believed to have been killed by the Northern Alliance and U.S. bombing of the prison. With the Taliban's control waning, representatives of four Afghan factions are meeting near Bonn, Germany, at a UN-sponsored meeting to map plans for a new Afghan government. The talks include the Northern Alliance, exiles backing former King Mohammad Zahir Shah, and two smaller exile groups representing all major Afghan ethnic groups, including the Pashtun, from which the Taliban draws much of its support. And there was a further indication this war is far from over, as George Bush rejected the International Olympic Committee's request for a military truce during the Winter Olympics next year. President Bush today meets with Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar, whose government has refused to extradite al-Qaeda suspects because it finds the secret military trials proposed by Bush unacceptable. Spain has arrested 14 suspects allegedly linked to Osama bin Laden since September 11th. Several of those in custody are believed to have given the hijackers logistical support. But Spanish officials say European Union directives prevent the detainees' extradition anywhere they would face a death penalty or trial by military court. Leaders of Britain's Conservative Tory Party are breaking ranks with Tony Blair in the so-called war on terrorism by backing calls by President Bush for possible U.S. military action against Iraq. The leader of the Tory Party begins a three-day visit to Washington today. In related news, U.S. jets attacked air defense targets in southern Iraq yesterday, and Baghdad rejected a demand from President Bush to allow United Nations weapons inspectors back in the country after the U.S. and Russia reached a deal to continue the current sanctions regime against Iraq for another 6 months. And Attorney General John Ashcroft, under increasing criticism for the Justice Department's campaign of mass detentions of immigrants, revealed yesterday the government is still detaining more than 600 people arrested since September 11th on federal immigration charges. Ashcroft named 104 people charged with federal crimes, a handful of which are connected to the FBI investigation of September 11th. But he refused to name the 500 people being held on alleged immigration charges with no obvious connection, any wrongdoing. Ashcroft said he wanted to protect the privacy of the innocent, many of whom have been held for weeks with no knowledge of the charges against them. Lawyers for the detained say their task has been greatly complicated by a new Justice Department policy to monitor conversations between them and their clients.
Children laugh, children cry, they're the ones who will survive. Will they know what we've sown? Nature's gift we've turned for gold.
House of Hope, Tony Childs here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Workers for the world's largest natural gas company, Enron, sued the company this week for $850 million they've lost in 401k retirement savings. The lawsuit alleges that Enron and other Enron-related defendants sold workers Enron stock knowing the price was artificially inflated, and locked workers into stock through the company's 401k plan. In recent weeks, the value of Enron stock has plummeted from a high of $90 to a low of $5. The fall in prices came in the wake of revelations that for years, Enron misled investors and concealed billions of dollars of debt through secret offshore partnerships set up to borrow and covertly funnel money to the company. While the stock price was still high, top Enron officials sold tens of millions of dollars of Enron stock, apparently knowing the prices would not last. The company's in the middle of buyout talks with its former competitor, Dynegy, but the discussion seems to have stalled in recent days, and bankruptcy remains an option. With revenues of $40 billion in 1999, Enron was the 18th largest company in the U.S. and was the largest national natural gas company in the world. Enron is invested in energy projects around the world, including Britain, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, the Philippines, Indonesia, India, and Mozambique. The corporation has come under harsh criticism by indigenous people and human rights and environmental advocates around the world. In one of its better-known projects, Enron entered into a controversial agreement with the Maharashtra state in India for a power generation project at Dabhol. The $3.5 billion power purchase agreement, the largest contract in history of India, and one of the largest single contracts, civilian or military, in the entire world, was pushed through without any public discussion or participation, without any competitive bidding, and amidst allegations of fraud, bribery, and corruption. According to Human Rights Watch, Enron's Dabhol subsidiary benefited directly from an official policy of suppressing dissent through police beatings and harassment of anti-Enron protest leaders, protesters. We're joined right now by several people to talk about the loss of the retirement funds of the workers at Enron, and also to talk about Enron's history. We're going to start with Prothap Chatterjee. He has for a long time investigated the natural gas giant and joins us on the phone now from Berkeley, California. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Prothap.
Amy, thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Before we go into the lawsuits, how workers had their retirement plans frozen as the company's stock plummeted, but the corporate executives sold their stocks. Let's talk about how significant Enron is and who its head is and how close he is to President Bush.
Well, Enron was, until quite recently, the 18th largest company in the United States in terms of its revenue and its stock value. And it was started by a man named Kenneth Lay, who was, until the company hasn't gone bankrupt, but it's close to. He was the chief executive officer and pretty much the founder. He founded the company by merging two companies. But before he got before he set up Enron itself, he worked in Washington, D.C. at a now defunct government agency called the Federal Power Commission. And following that, he worked and then he worked in the Pentagon during the Vietnam War when Richard Nixon was president. He has a PhD in economics, and he learned how government worked. And he used this knowledge in working in energy and for the government to figure out that there were profits to be made in this business, and particularly in deregulation and privatization of the energy industry, but particularly in the natural gas business. So when he left Washington, D.C. and went back to Texas, he started working for this company, and he set up Enron in order to take advantage of what he perceived as a potential future market in natural gas. And he created what was at one point the largest pipeline company in the United States. And he realized the profits were not really to be made in extracting natural gas and going out and seeking new energy, or even necessarily selling energy at the other end to the consumers. But really the big profit was to be made in between, was in running the pipelines and eventually running the contracts, so buying power from one group and reselling it to somebody else. And they started out doing this in Texas, but, you know, and quite recently they were, you know, very heavily involved in California, first offering power for sale to end consumers, but then largely acting as a broker. And they've done that around the world. They've done that particularly in India, but they've also been involved in contracts in the Philippines. They were trying to get involved in contracts in Argentina and in Kuwait.
And wasn't Ken Lay one of Bush's closest advisors, one of the pioneers raising the most money for his friend?
Indeed. Ken Lay was financially has been one of the biggest, in fact, the biggest donor to George Bush Jr.'s political fortunes. And he himself personally raised at least $100,000. As you say, he was called a pioneer for this previous election. And over the period of time that George Bush has been governor and run for political office, Ken Lay has personally been the biggest fundraiser for George Bush Jr., and Enron as a company has been the biggest corporate sponsor of George Bush's political fortunes. In Texas, you can actually raise more money than you can federally because the laws are a little different. He's been a big friend of the family. In fact, has helped both George Bush Jr. when he was governor of Texas, within Texas, but also in making calls for him to Argentina in order to help him secure contracts. So they go back a long way.
So what happened? How did the company fall so low, and what has happened to Ken Lay in the process?
Well, I think part of the reason Enron was so successful was because it used its political contacts in order to build up business. And so in a lot of countries, you know, there were questions raised as to how the company had gotten business. As I mentioned, in Argentina, you know, they got, you know, then-governor of Texas, George W. Bush, to put in a call for them. In India, there have been charges, never proven, that there were, you know, bribes paid to local officials and that kind of thing. But even here within the federal government, Ken Lay and Enron have been very involved in pulling strings, should we say, in order to get, you know, people in high places to give them favors. And their counting has left, you know, a lot to be desired, as we've discovered. But also, simply the way they've made their profit has been basically through clever accounting, by, you know, buying from one and selling to the next, and then, you know, taking a very large cut in between. And I think this is, you know, this is kind of where they came unstuck. It was all basically, at one point, they started to sell off their natural gas pipelines. They decided that actually physically owning a product or a system of pipelines was not where the profit was to be made. The profit was to be made in basically, you know, I would say ripping people off. But, you know, they would say, you know, in deregulation, in making markets. And Enron Online at one point was, you know, the world's largest trading business over the Internet, where they were buying and selling contracts in all manner of businesses, from natural gas to futures in the stock market. And,
I wanted to move Prothop from what they're doing now to what happened with the 401k pension plan, and bring in Eli Gottesdiener, a principal lawyer in the lawsuits that have just been filed. Can you explain what happened?
Well, what happened at the top of your presentation is pretty much what we know happened, is that the company was offering employees the opportunity in their 401k plan to purchase company stock, and they were not just offering them company stock among the menu of options that they were offering generally, but they were inducing employees to purchase the stock in a variety of ways, including by matching their contributions with company stock, by encouraging them to invest in company stock and demonstrate their loyalty to the company, by suggesting to them that the stock was going to go even higher. One official who was forced to resign in August before these disclosures started dripping out, which began in October, was touting the stock as likely to go as high as $120 a share, and it did reach a high of 90. But in all these ways, and undergirding this is a statute called the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which could be renamed the Company Stock Promotion Act that Congress enacted in 1974 with the best of intentions, but it provides a perverse incentive for companies to load employees up with company stock, and we might get into that in a minute to explain the historical, really, accident of how that came about. But the situation at Enron was such that folks had upwards of 62% at the beginning of the year, that's the latest data we have, of their entire portfolio socked away in company stock. And there's some...
And then that stock fell 90%.
That stock has plummeted, and we certainly hope that bankruptcy is not in the future for Enron, that the deal with Dynergy can go through. Because if it doesn't, there's going to be... There's going to be very little left. We're going to just have to stand in line in bankruptcy court with all the other creditors of the company.
We're going to be joined by Gary Kemper when we come back from our break. He's a vehicle maintenance foreman for an Enron subsidiary, has lost a lot of his pension, and he'll tell us his story. Also on the line with us, Prothop Chatterjee, Democracy Now! Correspondent, longtime energy reporter, has been following Enron for years, and Eli Gottesdiener, a lawyer who is representing the people who had pension plans in Enron. We'll be back in just a minute.
Shoutin' in your ear.
Carly Simon, back by James Taylor, doing Mockingbird here on the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the fall of the largest natural gas company in the world, Enron, and also what has happened to the workers for that company and its subsidiaries. On the line with us, Gary Kemper, who is a vehicle maintenance foreman for PGE and Enron subsidiary, speaking to us from Oregon. What happened to you?
Actually, what happened in the beginning was when we were still Portland General Electric, or before we had merged with Enron, we were offered in our 401k a chance to improve our matching funds to 6%, over 3% in money by taking company stock. But at the time, Portland General Electric, of course, was a private utility and franchised and was a very sound and solid company that they had the kind of stock that a person would really want in his portfolio, you know, because it was dependable, the dividends were dependable, and there was no large risk factor, but probably not a lot of room for large growth either. But then we merged with Enron, which was a stock-for-stock exchange, so all of our PG stock became Enron stock, which was a lot faster moving company, and the stock grew faster, and everybody was happy with that until lately. I have to admit, without being hypocritical, that myself, I was excited about it too. It was growing fast, and we were putting lots of money away on our 401ks and retirements. And then when the fall began, or when this all started, we all got caught blind, because for months we'd been told that in emails from Ken Lay and others, that Jeff Skilling later, that the company was on a sound foundation, and there was really no reason to worry about the stock.
Were your pension plans frozen?
Anyone under 50 wasn't allowed to move the stock. Actually, I'm 58 and hope to retire at 62. I'm not sure that's going to happen now, but you had to be over 50 to move your stock. And
what was happening with the corporate executive stock at the same time?
At the same time, or actually, unless you were really watching it close, at the same time, the corporate executives were selling huge amounts of stock and stock options, which puzzled a lot of us even when we found that out, because at the same time we were being told, and even the people like Merrill Lynch were saying, it's a good, sound, solid stock, you know, we shouldn't worry about it. So a whole lot of people in the company that had a lot of stock in the 401k didn't really catch on until it was too late, you know, that this really was going to be. Nobody ever dreamed that this could have happened, you know, that in such a short period of time that the company could be in this much financial trouble.
Prothap Chatterjee, how did Ken Lay himself do?
Well, he made $123 million in options, exercising his options, I believe, over the last couple of years. And that's in addition to his own salary. So he made $12 million in cash, I believe, in 2000. And another that's $143 million in a year alone. So he did very well.
So Eli Gottesdiener, how does the fact that the corporate executives could sell off, that the workers under 50 could not, play into this lawsuit?
Well, let me just give you a little background on the what we call the lockdown. How it plays into the lawsuit is, I mean, in a legal sense, Amy, it doesn't directly play in, other than to the extent that the people who were selling out and getting out while the getting was good had influence over the decisions with respect to the 401k plan, and we suspect, we don't yet know exactly who were the decision makers with respect to the 401k plan, but to the extent that there's some overlap, it will play in. But on a corporate level, whether one individual, you know, knew exactly what was going on, the corporation as a whole is liable, because it was and is a fiduciary. And under the law, a fiduciary owes the beneficiaries, the participants like Gary, the highest duty of loyalty, and the highest standard of care known to law. And what we have here is the company continuing to offer employees company stock, continuing to match them in company stock at a time when it knew or should have known, as a general corporate matter, that it had been cooking the books. And as we've heard, the ability of the company to sustain the profits and the trading it was engaged in, it was a very high-risk strategy. And in order to be a creditworthy partner for these very sophisticated trading contracts it was involved in, it had to show that it had the financial wherewithal to back up hedge contracts if a number of them went bad at any time. And that drove this strategy to keep in these offshore Cayman Island partnerships off-balance sheet debt so that investors would not see that the company was actually saddled with a lot more debt than it was, because, you know, it's a psychological thing almost with all these trades going on. If you can maintain the image that you're creditworthy and you can step up to the plate, you'll get more contracts. Basically, it became a house of cards, and the company knew or should have known that this was going to happen. I wanted to just briefly explain, because you raised it with Gary and you've mentioned it a couple times, so the listeners understand this. On top of all this, in addition to the fact that the company should not have been doing what it was doing vis-a-vis the 401k plan and keeping the 401k plan so heavily invested in company stock, when the company had to make a disclosure because of its third quarter losses and this scheme started unraveling and articles started appearing in mid-October in the Wall Street Journal explaining all these extremely unorthodox accounting procedures, at that very moment, the company elected to proceed with an administrative record-keeping change in the plan that had been in the works for several months, under which they were essentially switching vendors. Northern Trust Company was being replaced by Hewitt Associates. These are consultants and record keepers who run what is a complicated administrative task of keeping track of records and trades and so forth for the 401k plan, which has about 11,000 participants and $2 billion in assets. They decided to go ahead with a freeze that was required in order to reconcile the books that would last for several weeks, despite the fact that they knew that all this information was coming out to the market generally and employees in particular, and they froze them in their accounts. And they just basically said, even though people were besieging the company and saying, you know, why don't you delay or postpone this change, because it's the greatest crisis in the history of the company. The volatility of the stock is off the charts. Investors around the world and in the United States were dumping Enron stock because not only did they realize that the company was built on a house of cards, but to the extent that there's real assets and real value in the company, a lot of investors said, I just don't want to be, you know, associated with management that conducts themselves in this way. The employees had the same right as shareholders at that point in time to also vote with their feet. And yet the company, some people think it was a conspiracy. I don't think it was. I have been involved in this business for a long time, and I've seen boneheaded administrative moves before. I think it was a bureaucratic imperative. People just figured, hey, we've planned this, and we're just going to go ahead with it. And the effect, however, was for somebody like Gary and all the other people I represent, it was just adding insult to injury. The stock was going down the toilet, but there was still substantial value in the stock that could have been salvaged if people had been able to sell. But now the stock has been so beaten down as the market assimilates all this awful information about the company, where there's almost nothing left in it. And that's about just recently was when they lifted this administrative freeze. So there's a whole level of this which was unnecessarily inflicted a further damage, and again an insult to workers.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Prothap Chatterjee, did you ever expect to see Ken Lay and his company fall so far at a time when it was his allies that has risen to power in this country? I mean, President Bush, now the President of the United States, you would think all the ingredients were there for Enron to, take off further than it even had.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what I assumed. I've written a number of articles, as you mentioned, and I did a big piece for Corporate Watch last year in which I sort of predicted that they would do very well because, you know, their beneficiary, I guess, was in the White House, was hoping to get into the White House. So I assumed that they would get, you know, even more contracts. The Clinton administration has been very supportive of them because, once again, they've been very generous with their financial contributions to a number of people and hired, you know, former government officials from the previous Bush administration. So they've always done very well with government. So I am somewhat taken aback at how far they've fallen, but I'm not surprised because their business is run on, you know, basically, you know, cheating people out of their money is by buying something at one price, selling it at a higher price, and you know, clouding people's vision with, you know, a lot of numbers which make it appear really rosy, and then, you know, the moment the smoke clears, all of a sudden your money's gone. And at the same time, they've gotten away with tremendous environmental and human rights abuses, in particularly, for example, in India, where they built this big natural gas power plant near Bombay and hired local police who went in, you know, dragged women out of their houses who were objecting to the power plant being there. It's been, you know, very well documented by people like Amnesty International. So I'm not sorry, I'm afraid to say, to see them fall, but where Ken Lay and people are concerned, I'm really sorry that this has happened to the employees, but I'm not surprised because they have had no regard for local communities, whether they were in India or even in Texas, where they are resident and where they pay taxes. They have been consistently cutting the ground out from under local communities in Houston, where they're supposed to pay taxes, so they pay less money to the community. And in fact, have people can check out www.corpwatch.org. And they'll find a whole series of articles by me about what the company has done in terms of screwing over communities that depended on them, you know, local school districts.
Prothap, on that note, we're going to have to leave it. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Prothap Chatterjee, longtime reporter on issues of energy and oil and indigenous communities around the world. Eli Gottesdiener, a lawyer representing many of the workers at Enron who have lost well over half of their pensions. And Gary Kemper, one of the people who worked for Enron. You are listening to the War and Peace Report now as we talk about war and peace. Anywhere further removed from the bloodstained battlefields and mountain wilderness of Afghanistan would be hard to imagine than the German city of Bonn. But this is where 62 Afghans, 28 delegates, 10 alternate delegates, and 24 advisors, and two senior UN officials have assembled for their first rounds of negotiations on the future of Afghanistan. Delegates from the ruling Northern Alliance and three exile groups sat down together at a round table at the Petersburg Hotel near Bonn to begin a process of creating a new broadly based government that will take at least 2 years to complete. Western diplomats say the mood is conciliatory and that there had been a good start, but cautioned the delegates had not yet begun to discuss issues of substance, such as the introduction of a multinational force into Afghanistan to ensure security. Rival Afghan factions turned to discussing the details of a post-Taliban government today, with ex-King Zahir Shah's role high among the issues to resolve. The former king is 87. He's emerged as favorite to become the temporary head of state. Within the first 3 hours of yesterday's meeting, the delegates agreed to establish an interim government to run the country for 3 to 6 months. This would be followed by an emergency meeting of the Loya Jirga, the traditional gathering of tribal leaders needed to approve constitutional change to be held in the spring as early as March. A two-year transitional government would then discuss in detail a new constitution for Afghanistan that would incorporate respect for human rights, equal rights for women, and introduce some form of democracy. At the end of the transitional phase, the Loya Jirga would be reconvened to approve the final constitutional package. Today, we're going to talk about where women fit into all of these plans. We're joined by Fahima Danishgar, who is a spokesperson for Women for Afghan Women, as well as Sunita Mehta, who is a part of that group as well. They join us in our Firehouse studio. Fahima, what do you think as you look at your country, Afghanistan, and then at what's happening right now in Bonn?
Amy, I'd like to be optimistic about it and hope that the new process, which should include women, however, it doesn't, and that's where I'm hesitant, and it bothers me that only three women were asked to be a part of this assembly. I'm also hopeful that as it continues, more and more women will prevail and come forth and will be included. And I know there's a lot of women's organizations, Afghan women organizations, that are interested and are trying to be a part of that and are clamoring to be a part of the administration, the new one, that will take place in Afghanistan. Like you mentioned, if there is an emergency Loya Jirga, hopefully a part of that will include women as well.
The women who are represented right now in Bonn, you said there are three.
Yes.
Are they all delegates?
No, they've been asked to be there as observers and not as participants.
So none of the three can vote?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how did they end up there?
Well, one for certain I know is invited by the Northern Alliance. Rabbani, the president, the former president of Afghanistan, exclusively asked her to be there as an observer. The other two women, I think, are taking part just as organizational leaders and as observers to be a part of it. The other difficult question that you mentioned was who's going to secure Kabul? And that's a big question and something that I'm quite worried about. I think there needs to be a neutral security force inside of Kabul to ensure that the interim government will have security. Mm-hmm. As you know, right now, the Northern Alliance controls it, and they are willing to work with the new interim government. However, I'm a bit hesitant on that as well.
What do you think of the Northern Alliance?
I think that their past record speaks for itself, but I also think that they've somehow learned some of their lessons from the past, and I think that everyone's trying to bring peace, and if they're willing to stick to their word and cooperate with the new government, I have faith in them. But if they go back on their word and commit the atrocities that they did when they were in power in 92, then I will be very disappointed.
What kind of atrocities?
They committed massacres when they took over Kabul within different ethnic groups that were represented in the Northern Alliance. There was internal fighting amongst them. And as a cause of that, a lot of civilian lives were lost to it.
Malia Sarwari is also on the phone with us with the Afghan Women's Association in Berkeley. What are your thoughts about this meeting in Bonn and the role of women in a future Afghanistan, not to mention the current talks in Germany?
I'm very optimistic right now because as it stands, I think the Bonn conference is a golden opportunity for all the Afghan people to sit together on one table after such a long time. And the role of women, I wish that right now, as it is, I'm glad that there is a participation of three, but although I wish there had been more. But let's take it one by one right now. And my views for the Afghan women, I wish that their role will be just like they should have a role, just like the 1964 Constitution in Afghanistan, where women were given equal status to women, to men, so that they can sit down on one table and discuss everything under equal status. And this is very important. So I feel optimistic because I think this is the first step. And so hopefully, I'm very hopeful that something good will come out of this. I'm sure they have learned from the past that they will not commit the same mistakes as the past.
Malia Sarawi, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll come back to this discussion about the role of Afghan women in the new government of Afghanistan. Malia Sarawi is with Afghan Women's Association in Berkeley. And in the studio with us, Fahima Danishgar, spokesperson for Women for Afghan Women. We'll also speak with Sunita Mehta with SAKI, South Asian Women and Women for Afghan Women, and then find out why a New Hampshire woman walked to Ground Zero and laid there an American flag and a piece of a burqa. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. We shall not be moved. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the future of Afghanistan, as we talk about women in that future. There was a piece in the London Guardian that talks about Saraya Parlika. It says, every day since the Taliban fled Kabul, dozens of women have climbed the steps to Saraya Parlika's small third-floor flat in the shell of a Soviet-built housing block to sign up to the fastest-growing women's organization in Afghanistan. The flat was teeming with women yesterday, their blue burqas hitched up over the back of their heads, revealing lipstick and other makeup. Ms. Parlika had planned to lead a march to Kabul's UN headquarters. She said, we wanted to call women from all the streets of Kabul and go to the UN, and we were going to demand our rights, she said. If we demonstrate, we will throw off our burqas and we will throw them out forever. But she's quickly found that life for women in Kabul after the rout of the Taliban will not be as straightforward as ditching their burqas. On Sunday, she spoke by telephone to Yunis Qanouni, the powerful Northern Alliance interior minister, who's now the most important delegate at the Bonn talks. He told her she could not hold demonstrations. Parlika said, he said we couldn't march because of security problems. He said we can talk about it when he comes back to Bonn. She had asked the UN to take her to the Bonn talks as a delegate. She was refused. What do you think of the fact that the group of women, hundreds who did try to demonstrate last week in Kabul, were turned back, not by the Taliban, but by the Northern Alliance, as this organization, Union of the Women of Afghanistan, which has thousands of people, has operated secretly for years, tried to say, if we're free, we want to show it.
I think that it might have something to do with security. Again, Kabul has not been fully secured, and I think that the Northern Alliance might be afraid of any type of demonstration by any group. However, I do think that it's unfair and that they should have been allowed to demonstrate and protest if they wanted to. And I think that by silencing them, it's not going to resolve the issue, especially after so many years of suppression. I think that these women have a right to speak up and demand what they want of the Northern Alliance. I mean, the Northern Alliance had promised that once they were in power, they would implement certain rights for women as part of their constitution and as part of their government.
We are talking to Fahima Danishgar, spokesperson for Women for Afghan Women. Also in the studio with us, Sunita Mehta. Now, Sunita, you're Indian. You're not Afghan. Why are you involved with Women for Afghan Women?
I'm one of the co-founders of Women for Afghan Women. And as a person from India, as somebody who moved away at age one and grew up abroad, I don't feel... One good thing about being uprooted is that you probably would never be a nationalist. I really feel India and all the countries in the Indian subcontinent reaching out all the way to Afghanistan are one land block. Our histories are intertwined, and I don't feel separate from any sisters around the world, and especially not sisters in South Asia. I was drawn very naturally to this struggle.
You're part of the organizing of a conference at the CUNY Graduate Center this week, Thursday and Friday. That's the City University of New York. Can you talk about this gathering of four Afghan women?
The gathering is a two-day conference being organized by us, a very fledgling grassroots organization that's committed to being rooted in community. And hearing the conversation about the Northern Alliance and the future of Afghanistan, I just realize over and over again that most women feel very distant from the decisions that are going to be made. Women, even in our country, feel very distant from decisions made at that level. And so our commitment is to making sure that conversations happen among women at the community level. This conference is going to bring together Afghan women and other women who are key players in the fight for the rights of Afghan women. The priority is that Afghan women's voices be showcased, and that other women who are there, really, however important they are and however much they're leaders in the struggle, that they come in a supportive role. I've, as an Indian woman, as a part of Women for Afghan Women, have been learning how a feminist who is not Afghan can support the Afghan women's struggle. And one thing I find is to really understand and accept that the majority of Afghan women are Muslim and that their struggle is within an Islamic context. And sometimes when I'm in a sort of Western feminist arena, I don't see that basic concept is understood and respected. And one thread that runs throughout our conference is the fact that it is an Islamic nation, and this is Ramadan, and this is something that most people of the country embrace very dearly. And so I think there's a complex sort of twist that comes when our group gets involved and organizes that's a little maybe difficult for other people in this movement. But that's what we bring, and I think it comes from being rooted in community.
Speaking of non-Afghan women for Afghan women, we're also joined on the telephone from New Hampshire by Pamela Claft, who is an X-ray technician and mother who walked from New Hampshire to Ground Zero to draw attention to women's exclusion from the Afghan negotiations. Pamela Claft, can you tell us why you did this?
Yes, I did this to draw attention to the women's issues in Afghanistan, to make sure that they were part of the delegates and heard at the meeting.
And what did you do once you got to Ground Zero?
When I got there, I placed an American flag and a piece of a burqa veil at the site to memorialize all the victims of the Taliban and the fundamentalists.
Had you had any connection to this issue before?
Not really, no. I had vaguely known about some problems, but basically I was living in a vacuum.
Uh-huh. And how long did it take you to take this walk?
The walk was 2 weeks long.
And what caused you to make the leap from being an X-ray technician and a mom to actually walking outside and then just continuing right on to New York?
Well, it wasn't quite that easy. There was a lot of preparations, but watching the news and doing a lot of research over the internet on the issues facing Afghan women, I decided that as an American woman, as a woman, that something needed to be done, and I chose that I would be the one to do it.
You're also an Army reservist?
I was in the past. I did 12 years in the Army Reserve.
Mm-hmm. Why the burqa and the American flag?
Both to represent the different victims of the Taliban.
Fahima Danishgar, when you hear what Pamela Klaft did, a non-Afghan woman, what do you think?
I think it's absolutely commendable. However, I'd like to add that women were not the only victims of the Taliban. I think any Afghan who disagreed with Taliban etiquettes and rules was a victim of that. And I think it's great to raise the awareness and bring out the issue of Afghan women who suffered, but I think it should be inclusive of Afghan men and children as well. And I also like to mention, Amy, that in Herat, a cosmopolitan city where Ismail Khan, the general, has taken control again, has met with a group of women and has created a committee of five women who would be responsible for urging women's rights. So some of the Northern Alliance has been talking with women. It just, I think in Kabul is where they denied them the protest.
What do you think of the continued bombing of Afghanistan right now?
I necessarily don't agree with it. I think that enough of the bombing. I think that it's time to start rebuilding and start finding the terrorists from within by sending in ground troops and not by bombing. I think enough destruction has been done.
Mm-hmm. On the line with us also, as we said before, in Berkeley, California, Malia Sarwari of Afghan Women's Association. What about this issue that Sunita was raising of Muslim women, and also what has become the symbol of the women of Afghanistan, the burqa? Do you see anything redeeming in the burqa or the head covering if it's not a full burqa?
As a Muslim woman, I think just a scarf would be sufficient. Of course, this transition has to be done very slowly because amongst those people in Kabul, you don't know what kind of people are in there. That's why I think the security is important at this stage. I know and I think that women will be given definitely a chance to raise their voice, but I think their security themselves and their families is the first step that they need to be extremely cautious about taking off their burqa. Of course, the burqa, I don't even understand the reason why they should have the burqa, because in Islam, this is something cultural. It's not Islamic. Islam, a scarf would be just sufficient for them, just to cover their head. And so this is just a symbolic thing that the Taliban have brought, because they wanted the women to be secure in that manner, but then they've imprisoned women, and they've killed the women's rights. So basically they had no rights at this stage. But in Islam, just to cover their heads, I think that would be sufficient. And then they can go according to what the needs are. But at this stage, I condemn the burqa in the full, because that's something that would keep women in the dark. As you know, Afghanistan in the 1960s were very much ahead, especially the Afghan women issue. They were allowed to be equal in the constitution. They were allowed to participate in the Loya Jirga. So why women at that time in 1964, when other Islamic countries were so far behind us, we were way ahead of most of those countries there. And at this point, I hope that the Bonn conference can bring about positive results, which I hope it will, because this is a golden opportunity for our nation to sit together, all of us, and resolve the differences, and especially the women's rights. I think they will not be able to make the past mistakes again, because they will see it.
Last words for our guests in the Firehouse studio. Fahima Danishgar, you don't wear even a veil. Are you Muslim?
I am Muslim. I think in Islam, modesty is asked of all its worshippers, and it's dependent on personal interpretation and what you interpret that to be. And to me, what I'm wearing currently is modest. One last thing. I think it's very important and crucial at this moment that the world realizes that it's the Afghan people who should decide their future government and not any neighbors or outside forces that should basically force feed them into anything. And I think the Bonn Conference is very vital for that.
And Sunita Mehta, if people want to find out about the conference that'll take place at CUNY, City University of New York, where can they call or go on the web?
They can go on the web to www.womenforafghanwomen.org, and there's information about the conference there. They can also call me, 212-260-4446, and I can give information.
That number again?
212-260-4446. The conference is free of charge, and everybody is welcome. And I hope that we have a full house.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Last comment from Fahima. Laura Bush, the First Lady, has gathered 11 women exiled from Afghanistan around her as she spoke at the beginning of the Bonn talks in Washington, D.C., talking about the importance of the conference, saying we have to make sure that the Afghan government will be diverse and include everyone. Your thoughts on the First Lady weighing in?
I think it's wonderful that she has taken this step, and I think that she should encourage it more and make it part of U.S. policy that that happens.
How?
By having the president and his administration push for it, and also getting involved with the UN aspect of it as well.
Well, I want to thank you all again for being with us. On the line with us was Malia Sarwari of Afghan Women's Association in Berkeley. Also, Pamela Klaft, the X-ray technician who walked from New Hampshire to Ground Zero. And you can get more information on Women for Afghan Women at, that title.org on the web, womenforafghanwomen.org. Fahima Danishgar, thanks for being with us. And you are listening to the War and Peace Report as we conclude today. If you'd like to email us, you can send us mail at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. And in this holiday season, if you are looking to give, Democracy Now in Exile could use your support. So you can go to the web at democracynow.org, find out about how you can help us out with our workstations and computers. You can also send your support to us at Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report, P.O. Box 693, New York, New York, 10013. That's P.O. Box 693, New York, New York, 10013. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at WBIX.org, where we broadcast on the web. You can also go to our own website at democracynow.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA. Aaron Glantz at Free Speech Radio News, KPFA in general, and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno. To all our Pacifica affiliates who are airing Democracy Now! In Exile around the country, we are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from downtown community television, thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Public Access TV in New York, and on Public Access TV stations around the country. You can ask your cable access station to air us as well. Also broadcasting on 9415 channel of Dish Network. That's Free Speech Channel on the Dish Network. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBI Studios, abandoned fired studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile. As the mainstream media cheers the talks in Germany on the future government of Afghanistan, human rights activist Madia Benjamin leads a delegation to Afghanistan to find out what women want. Public health crisis, should the government be allowed to force patients to be vaccinated, take over hospitals, and seize drug supplies? We'll have a debate. And we'll hear reflections of a Palestinian-American woman living in fear in a post-September 11th world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The military campaign inside Afghanistan entered a new phase yesterday when 500 Marines were flown in close to the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar. One Marine told an AP reporter, "We're all psyched up about actually going and getting some payback." Northern Alliance troops, aided by U.S. Special Forces, have killed the last of hundreds of Taliban prisoners of war in Kunduz who launched an uprising and then refused to surrender. U.S. warplanes launched up to 30 airstrikes overnight against the prison where Taliban fighters were originally detained following their surrender over the weekend. Victorious Northern Alliance troops swept into Kunduz in brutal style yesterday, shooting wounded prisoners and leaving them to die in the city's marketplace as they ended a two-week resistance by Taliban forces in their last stronghold in northern Afghanistan. And 12 years after Soviet fighters were forced to withdraw in humiliation, armed Russian troops are back in Afghanistan. At least 60 armed Russian troops describing themselves as medical personnel have arrived in Kabul. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the soldiers are there to perform humanitarian work. UN-sponsored peace talks between Afghan factions began in Bonn today, with regional stability and billions of dollars in international aid at stake. The four delegations, three Afghan exile groups, and the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance face huge international pressure to make the talks a success. The U.S. has linked the prospect of billions of dollars in reconstruction aid to the creation of an interim administration and improved human rights by Afghanistan's new rulers. We're going to talk about women's role in a new Afghan government tomorrow when women from Afghanistan join us in the studio before a conference they'll be having here in New York on Thursday. A Swedish television journalist was killed early today in northern Afghanistan. Colleagues identified him as Olaf Stromberg of Sweden's TV4. They said he was shot during a break-in at the house where he was staying. He's the eighth journalist to die in Afghanistan since the U.S. began bombing October 7th. In Washington yesterday, President Bush suggested again that Iraq could be the next target of U.S. military attack and warned Saddam Hussein to let United Nations weapons inspectors into the country or face the consequences. Bush singled out President Saddam Hussein as evil and said it's up to him to prove he's not. In recent days, the president has expanded his threat to attack countries that harbor suspected terrorists to include those that develop weapons of mass destruction, suggesting repeatedly Iraq is trying to develop a nuclear capability. Federal officials yesterday released a draft plan of the government's response to major bioterror attacks. The report states that in the event of such an attack against the U.S. involving the smallpox virus, health authorities could impose measures as drastic as banning public events, halting regional transport, placing entire cities under quarantine. The CDC has already developed plans for dealing with smallpox that could involve the closing of hospitals and forced vaccinations of millions of people. We'll have a debate on this plan later in the program. Two Palestinians sprayed gunfire at a bus station and market in northern Israel today, killing two Israelis, wounding 36 others before police shot the gunman dead. The attack in the city of Afula took place shortly after two U.S. envoys held talks with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the start of a mission to end the 14-month-old Palestinian intifada. Sharon greeted the mission by shunting aside Shimon Peres and replacing him with a retired hardline general, Meir Dagan. Dagan's a former Israeli death squad leader who helped assassinate dozens of Palestinians in the 70s and who helped to create the brutal South Lebanese army during Israel's war against Lebanon. Also in Gaza, Palestinian hospital officials said five children, including an 18-month-old baby, were wounded by shrapnel overnight when Israeli tanks shelled the Khan Yunis refugee camp. The Bush administration, reversing a Clinton policy, has told the pesticide industry it can pay volunteers to swallow doses of pesticides and use the data from such tests for its research, siding with manufacturers who say such studies are ethical and scientifically valid. The new policy, which the Environmental Protection Agency has not announced, disregards the recommendations of a scientific panel. The policy could have a significant impact because it comes as the government is beginning to reassess about 9,000 pesticide safety levels to reflect their impact on children. President Bush said the recession officially declared Monday should act as a clarion call for Congress to quickly approve an economic stimulus plan. Congress is locked in deep partisan disagreements over economic stimulus, with Bush administration officials stressing corporate tax cuts and Democrats insisting on new help for the unemployed. And Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said yesterday he has no plans to rush a ban on human cloning through Congress. President Bush, joined by a chorus of religious and political leaders, condemned the work of a Massachusetts biotech company that said this weekend it had created human embryos through cloning.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end and you're gonna rock the other, it's the same boat, brother. Oh, Lordy, look down. Come is a holy place. He said, Lord, and me, what a sea of space. What a spot to launch the human race. So if you're on board for a mixed up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue. So that's how come that you and I got just one world and just one sky. We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end and you're gonna rock the other, it's the same boat, brother.
We're in the same boat, brother, Lead Belly, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. Marines secure Afghan foothold. Alliance captures final city in north. Taliban may surrender key southern area. Afghan leaders in diplomatic lockdown. These are a few of today's top headlines from the mainstream U.S. papers, but the silences are deafening. Talks on the future government of Afghanistan opened in Germany today, with U.S., Russia, Pakistan, Iran, and others exerting strong influence from the sidelines. The talks are between four factions. The U.S.-backed Northern Alliance, a group of exiles backing former King Mohammed Zahir Shah, and two smaller exile groups. The media reports the German foreign minister's opening appeal to forge a truly historic compromise that holds out a better future for your torn country and its people. But scant attention has been paid to the fact that of the 25 delegates at the table, only two are women. And the UN Children's Fund told journalists yesterday, Afghanistan's fast approaching bitter winter, combined with lack of security left by the U.S. bombing, could leave 100,000 Afghan children dead in the next few weeks. Epidemic diseases spreading through Afghan refugee camps near Iran have already claimed the lives of hundreds of children in the past few weeks alone. But no major U.S. paper has reported the story. Well, the San Francisco-based human rights group, Global Exchange, is going to where the silences are. Global Exchange has sent a delegation of four women to the Pakistan-Afghan border, where they've spent the last week talking with refugees. The women will enter Afghanistan in the next few hours to talk to women about what they want for their country. We're joined on the phone by Medea Benjamin. She's founding director of Global Exchange and former Green Party senatorial candidate from California. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thanks for having me on, Amy. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to be with you. Medea Benjamin joins us from Peshawar. What are you hearing right now?
We've been visiting the refugee camps and speaking to Afghan refugees for the last 5 days. And, Amy, the stories are just heartbreaking. I've never met a people that have experienced so much suffering over so many years. We've been going into people's homes, which usually consists of one room with up to 15 people trying to squeeze and sleep inside of it. Children who don't have enough to eat, people who've been traumatized because everybody has lost somebody. And what is also overwhelming is the number of people we find who have fled since the U.S. started bombing, and how difficult life is for those recent refugees. In fact, more difficult than for the refugees who have come here in earlier years.
And the bombing is continuing.
Well, the bombing is continuing, and there is a flood of about 2,000 Afghan refugees into Pakistan every day now. And these refugees are considered illegal refugees. In fact, they have to sneak in through a border that's been closed, and they're not allowed legally inside the refugee camps, which means they don't get UN support. They don't get a tent. They don't get a house. They don't get rations. They're not on the books to have their children go to the clinics or the schools. So these are the ones who are really suffering from the U.S. attacks and the ones who are really left to fend for themselves. We find many, many women still in their burqas, I might add, who are on the streets begging. We visited clinics where they say about half the children are malnourished. And once again, we want to stress that most of these people are people who have come since September 11th.
Can you talk about what they say about the U.S. bombing?
Well, there is a lot of contradiction in people's own minds, because when you hear the horrible stories of the...
Medea, are you there? Well, we sometimes have this trouble with the telephone where occasionally it just cuts off completely. She may well be able to hear us. Medea?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, we can hear you again, so go ahead.
So I was saying that while people are very contradictory about their feelings towards the United States, they were so anxious to get rid of the Taliban, but everyone tells us also about the abuses they suffered under the Northern Alliance. And they feel that the United States has not demonstrated that it is really making a commitment to the Afghan people. In fact, everybody says...
There it goes again. This often happens where, especially if we tape people during the day, they will go off for a minute. They can hear us, and then they come back. Medea Benjamin is with us from Peshawar. I think she's back. Are you there, Medea?
Yes, I'm sorry. Is the phone line going in and out?
Yeah, it's going in and out. You don't have to shout, though, when you're speaking, because it's easier to hear you when you don't. Go ahead with what you're saying.
So I was saying how in the people's attitude towards the United States is they want to see what the U.S. is going to put into reconstruction. People understand that...
Well, we will try it one more time. Again, here she is again. Go ahead. People understand that. I rarely hear silences when I talk to Medea Benjamin, but I think this has nothing to do with what's in her power right now. Again, Medea Benjamin is on the border, and she's in Peshawar with several other women from the Global Exchange delegation. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, Amy, just fine.
Okay, keep going.
So,
well,
towards the United States. Did you lose me again?
Say that last sentence again.
People are very contradictory in their attitude towards the United States. They are not trusting that the United States will put money into feeding the massive number of refugees and rebuilding the country. So there is a general feeling of skepticism about why the United States is bombing Afghanistan and what it will do when the bombing stops.
You know, it's interesting. I was just watching CNN where Paula Zahn was interviewing Gloria Steinem about women's involvement in the bond talks. And as a side issue, Paula Zahn said about something Steinem had said, "You're not saying, are you, that you are opposed to the bombing of Afghanistan?" She was absolutely floored that anyone would express anything like that. But let's talk about the women of Afghanistan, what role they will play, and how much their voice is being heard. Medea Benjamin.
Well, we are very excited, as are women here, that there are women that are included in the talks happening right now in Bonn, and the separate talks that will begin this Saturday in Berlin for civil society, and there have been at least 20 women that have been invited to that. The problem is that this has been chosen in a very undemocratic way for the meeting in Berlin, the United Nations that has chosen which women are to be invited. So women here are gathering in many wonderful organizations that are run by women, and I must say we've been so impressed by the women doctors and lawyers and women running the schools and women working with street children and all kinds of women that have proven over many years their dedication to the poor of Afghanistan. But these women feel that there should be a much better process in terms of determining who should represent the women of Afghanistan.
Is it your understanding that only of women representing the Northern Alliance are included in these talks, though there are other observers?
Well, our understanding is that there are a few other women who have been invited, but that in the meeting of the civil society, there have been quite a number of women invited. At first, it was only going to be men, but there was so much pressure on both of these meetings that women be included. And that pressure is coming not just from the international community, but is really coming from both inside Afghanistan as well as from the exile community. And some of the most important women in terms of women who have played roles in the government of Afghanistan in the past are now living in exile. They are highly skilled, and they have been waiting for many years for this moment. And they are the ones that are putting a lot of pressure on the United Nations, on the Northern Alliance, on the King and his representatives that they be included.
Finally, Medea Benjamin, the issue of refugees being allowed into Pakistan. Marines say they're there to stop refugees from going into Pakistan, supposedly to stop the Taliban from moving into Pakistan. But that also means how many refugees and how able are they to get over the border?
It's very difficult for them. We've talked to elderly people in their 70s and 80s, women who just gave birth and were taking babies that were a few days old, and how they had to walk and walk and walk through the mountains and able to get to a part of the border that was not being monitored and then slip through the border. And then, of course, once they're inside, because they're not there legally, they have all kinds of trouble, not only not getting the rations that the UN is supposed to give to refugees, but they're also at the mercy of the local police who know that they are there illegally. And these people are working for next to nothing because this is a very poor country in Pakistan itself, and having to absorb millions of refugees from Afghanistan has been very difficult. So the Afghanis are at the bottom of the totem pole and work literally for sometimes a dollar, $2 or $3 a month.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Medea Benjamin joining us from the border from Peshawar, Pakistan, where she is with a delegation of women who hope to go into Afghanistan. Yes, Medea?
I just wanted to say, yes, we'll be entering Afghanistan tomorrow, and this is the road that has been where the four journalists were killed, which is why a lot of people are waiting on the border until it's safer. So we're going halfway in tomorrow into Jalalabad, which is the safe part of the road. I should add that the area here between Pakistan and Afghanistan is really seen right now as the Wild West, with nobody being in control. And it is a terrible security situation, not just for the journalists and the foreigners, but more importantly for the people who are living there. And the ethnic divisions are being heated up as the Northern Alliance and the Taliban situation is getting more and more difficult. But I would also just like to add that Global Exchange, when we get back, will be doing a lot of work to be promoting women's voices during this whole transition period. And we look forward to your listeners getting in touch with us so that we can work together to make sure that women are included in the new government and that the U.S. does put massive amounts of money into taking care of the refugees and to reconstructing Afghanistan.
Medea Benjamin speaking to us from Peshawar, Pakistan. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to look at public health measures that the administration is putting forward in emergency situations. A debate. Stay with us.
And I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
Also on the faces of people passing by.
I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? What they are really saying is, I love you. I hear babies crying. Watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I say to myself, what a wonderful world.
Victoria Williams and Vic Chestnut, What a Wonderful World, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, the Bush administration has relied increasingly on a rhetoric of national security and public safety to justify restrictions on civil liberties. So far, the Bush strategy has centered on immigration and criminal justice, including the detention of over 1,100 people and the creation of a military tribunal system. Now, the Bush administration will expand this approach to another frontier, public health. While most states already possess emergency health statutes, the president is pushing states to adopt a law that will vastly expand their powers. The act would grant authorities new powers to take over hospitals, seize drug supplies, quarantine people exposed to infectious pathogens, and draft doctors to treat them. It would also give them permission to force patients to be vaccinated and order police to restrain residents from leaving contaminated areas. The proposed legislation is known as the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. The CDC commissioned a Georgetown law professor, Lawrence Gostin, to write the act at the height of the anthrax scare and then rushed it to state legislatures as soon as it was complete. According to the Washington Post, some variation of the measure is expected to be considered in virtually every state in the coming year. But public health experts, civil libertarians, AIDS activists, and others have begun to raise serious questions about the CDC template. We're joined right now by Lawrence Gostin, who wrote the legislation commissioned by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, director of the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown University. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out what the basic tenets are of this bill?
Well, the bill requires all states to have in place emergency plans for a possible bioterrorist attack or for other novel and emerging infectious diseases. It requires them to have good surveillance so that there is an early identification, early warning system, if you will, for bioterrorism, and also good communication between public health, law enforcement, and emergency management. And then it provides a set of powers in relation to property, for example, things like vaccinations and pharmaceuticals to ensure that there are sufficient supplies, and then also deals with issues involving individuals in terms of their vaccination, testing, treatment, and as a last resort, isolation or quarantine. I think that's a short précis of a very long, complicated but important bill.
On the issue of vaccination, would it require vaccination in some cases, like, for example, smallpox?
Yes, it would require vaccination. If there was a highly infectious disease and there were a vaccination available, I think most, if not virtually all, sensible people in the country would agree that there'd need to be vaccination. And if a person didn't want to vaccinate themselves, then there could be compulsion. I think you could perhaps imagine sending an unvaccinated child to a school where smallpox was a possibility of exposure.
We know the situation of forced vaccination because particularly of the military during the Persian Gulf War, and a
right.
lot of people believe that there were serious problems with those vaccinations that led to Gulf War syndrome. Smallpox is a very, the vaccine can have very serious consequences,
yes.
comes with a great risk. How do you force people to take a vaccine that could kill them?
Well, the chances that they would be killed by smallpox if they're unvaccinated would have to be much greater than the chance of them being harmed by the vaccine. It's true to say that many vaccines, and including and perhaps particularly smallpox, do have risks, but the risks are exceedingly low. I would not be in favor of vaccinating the population in the absence of an outbreak, but if there were an outbreak of smallpox, people might just forget the devastation of infectious diseases. The disease itself would be far worse, far more costly to human lives than the vaccination. I mean, it's really they can't even be spoken in the same breath. The risks are so different.
We're also joined on the telephone by George Annis, who is chair of the Health Law Department at the Boston University School of Public Health. You're concerned about the proposal that has been put forward, the proposed legislation by the CDC, written by Lawrence Gostin, on the line with us. Can you talk about your criticism?
Well, basically, I think this is a solution for a problem that we don't have. I mean, as Larry just said, he envisions maybe some people not wanting to get their children vaccinated, or maybe one or two strange people not wanting to get vaccinated. That's not going to be the problem in a bioterrorist attack. The problem is going to be panic, and the problem is going to be what standards are applied to people when we quarantine whole cities, what you do in that kind of an epidemic. And I think that deputizing a whole bunch of public health workers, giving them badges, and giving them arbitrary powers to order doctors to treat people, to order people to be treated, to order people quarantined, is just exactly the wrong way to go, because it treats American citizens as if they're the enemy. The people you want to catch and quarantine are the bioterrorists, not American citizens who are trying to do whatever they can do to cooperate. And we know from the anthrax attacks that Americans are not resisting treatment. Americans are demanding treatment, are lining up to get treatment. It's the CDC that's telling them to go away. It's the CDC that's saying you don't have to take Cipro. In fact, don't take Cipro. That you don't have to be screened for anthrax if you weren't directly exposed. So I just think this is a statute that comes from the 19th century. It doesn't help us. In fact, it's counterproductive to the issues that we face right now.
So what do you suggest?
I suggest those first things that Larry talked about, emergency planning, stockpiling vaccines, trying to coordinate federal and state efforts. All those things, however, are not going to be touched by state legislation. These are issues that require federal legislation, like the Frist-Kennedy bill on bioterrorism, which I think is exactly the way to go. And I think the CDC actually thinks that's the way to go, too. I think if you talk to any public health people, they will tell you what you need now is funding. What you need now is new vaccines. What you need now is new drugs. What you need now is more work on the bioweapons convention. What you don't need are more extraordinary arbitrary powers that public health people don't really know how to exercise.
When you talk about the bioweapons convention, do you mean the bioweapons protocol that the U.S. walked away from this summer.
Yes, I mean, the one that the president first said in the spring that we're not interested in because the inspection is too bad on our pharmaceutical companies. They really don't like it. I think we have a new view on that now, that we need heavy-duty international inspection to make sure that scientists are not developing new pathogens for which we have no vaccines and for which we have no defense, and that the only way to deal with those is first-line prevention, which is to prevent the pathogens from being developed in the first place. These kind of new weapons of mass destruction are what we should be aiming at, again, trying to prevent their development, not trying to figure out how we can quarantine Americans in case they're attacked.
We're also joined on the line by Dr. Keith Richman, who is a Republican California State Assembly member who's working to adapt the CDC proposal into legislation for California. Can you lay out what your bill will look like?
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the show. My bill is modeled after Dr. Gostin's template. Let me say that I think it's a very important bill and a bill that sets up a framework for preparedness for the state of California in the case of a bioterrorist attack. I think it's very important to differentiate between diseases. If we're faced with a bioterrorist attack with an entity like smallpox, we're looking at potentially 30% of the people who contact the disease dying from the illness. And I think it's very important that the state is prepared for that type of situation. Certainly what Dr. Anna said about having provisions for planning, stockpiling of pharmaceuticals and other supplies, coordination of state and federal and local responses are all very important, and in fact are part of Dr. Gostin's template and part of my legislation. Besides that, the bill does address issues that are potentially very controversial and very contentious, but I think need to be debated in an open discourse like we're doing here this morning. Issues of quarantine and isolation of patients, treatment with vaccinations are all very difficult issues, but I think are important to discuss and debate before we're faced with the situation so that it can become part of our planning and, in fact, the coordination of the state, federal, and local response.
We're also joined by Tanya Ehrman, who is Director of Public Policy at AIDS Action, which is a network of over 3,000 AIDS service organizations around the country. You've expressed great concern about the CDC proposed legislation and what the states will adapt. Can you talk about it specifically in reference to AIDS?
Sure, and thank you for having me this morning. I think a couple of the points that have come up about where we're going with this language and what's going to be happening, I think the same kind of questions we're talking about today have come up with everything that we've been talking about with Department of Justice and other entities. You know, when do state powers become so broad that they threaten the American way of life? The definition of a public health emergency that is contained in the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act is so broad that it encompasses HIV and AIDS. It could encompass the flu or hepatitis. And when we talk about something so broad and then overlay that with something like smallpox, well, you know, you talked about the vaccine and whether there would be people who would be unwilling to take a vaccine. From the AIDS perspective, we've been left out of this vaccine. We would be, you know, as eager as anyone else in the case of a public health emergency to get our hands on a vaccine, but we know that the smallpox vaccine that exists right now is not safe for us. It's not safe for our community. And so we have lots of things to work through. And in terms of having an open debate to talk about these issues, it seems like because of the situation we were in, we have not had as much open debate prior to these guidelines being released into the public's view before to talk about these issues before now they're being sort of adopted by people like Dr. Richman and other states around the country. You know, things like quarantine and isolation and names reporting and closing facilities that are known to harbor disease are perfectly reasonable in the case of smallpox. But when you put that from, you know, in an AIDS lens, that's quite different. and the issues that come up for us are quite different. We're 20 years into an AIDS epidemic in this country, and we know what works in HIV prevention and AIDS care, and NAMES reporting is something that's decided at the state level, and quarantine and isolation are certainly not things that we are interested in seeing occur, you know, within our community.
Dr. Gostin, author of the legislation proposed by the CDC, your response?
Well, I'm glad you had me on because there are a lot of misconceptions floating out there, and I'd like to clear them up. A number of things that George said I certainly agree with. Very thoughtful, intelligent. He had said what public health professionals want. Do they want more money? Yes. Do they want a better infrastructure? Yes. He's absolutely right on that, and in fact, America has the public health system it deserves because it's been chronically underfunded. But public health professionals also want modern, effective laws. In fact, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers and the National Association of County and City Health Officers, all the health officers in the country, are strongly supporting this bill. So if we want to know what public health people want, they do want modern, clear laws. The term arbitrary has been used a number of times. This statute is the furthest from arbitrary that I can think of. It's been carefully looked at by the Department of Justice, by attorneys general across the country. It has very, very clear standards. And it is true, of course, vaccination and quarantine would not be needed very often. In fact, I hope it isn't needed. But the idea that someone could refuse a vaccination or would be refusing to be isolated when they're infectious and to mingle around the population, no common sense view would allow for that. And what this law does is far from be a violation of civil liberties. It tightens up standards, rights to individuals that don't exist under the current law. And then finally, Tanya's point. Again, I think Tanya makes a very good point. We do know what's effective for AIDS, and we do not intend for this law to affect the AIDS epidemic. In fact, we've written commentary. There's commentary now that shows that this is not the intent of the drafters. We're talking about bioterrorism or novel infectious diseases, not endemic diseases like flu or AIDS. So I wanted to reassure the AIDS community that this is not intended to affect them.
Tanya Ehrman, are you reassured?
Well, I'm glad to hear that, but when people around the country are already taking what exists now, and I appreciate that it's going through sort of a comment and revision period and using it, you know, we've sort of put something out on the table already. And so I'm very concerned that, you know, notwithstanding Professor Gostin's comments, that states are going to enact what they're seeing right now on paper, and that could give them broad authority because the definition right now includes epidemics and pandemics, and that certainly, you know, we certainly qualify in that criteria, and that all of these things could start happening. So, you know, it's a matter of sort of where we talk to people and where they are in their process, and also what occurs at the federal level and how tight that language is.
Keith Richman, your response, and especially on the issue of naming names, for example, and issues of privacy.
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, let me say also that I have no intention of including AIDS in this bill. And let me also say that the legislative process is one that works out these type of issues, and the way that you get the open debate in a legislative process is to propose a bill and then hear it in the legislature and work out these issues of concern to people. The issue of privacy and naming names in a bioterrorist attack with smallpox is very important. There's no question that the civil liberties are different in a situation where 30% of people might die. It's important that public health authorities, public safety authorities, have the information and the ability to share information if someone has smallpox, as an example. We are in that type of situation trying to prevent 30% of a population from dying.
Tanya Ehrman, your response.
It's very important that extraordinary steps be able to be taken in that type of public health emergency.
Tanya Ehrman.
I don't disagree with any of the comments. I'm a public health professional myself. I don't disagree with any of the comments about what kind of situation we would be in if we were facing smallpox. That is clearly a very different situation in terms of the transmission of the disease and everything else than we've talked about in the AIDS community. But I will just again bring up the point about the smallpox vaccine that currently exists, which does not work for us. And that, you know, I've been heartened to see some people around the country starting to talk about the need to develop a better vaccine, because the vaccine we have now is inadequate, and some of it gets back to funding issues, because unless we spend some time and resources on doing some work to get a better vaccine, instead of helping people with the vaccine we have in the case of the AIDS community, we will be harming a great number of people.
We're going to have to wrap up the discussion here, but I will just raise on the issue of State Assemblyman Keith Richmond saying that this is why we need a full discussion of these bills, that in a time of national emergency, it seems it's precisely, and we see it now since the bombing of Afghanistan, precisely a time when there isn't that space for open discussion, when issues of questions are raised as issues of patriotism. Keith Richmond.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important that an open discussion be held. This is not a bill that is going to quickly fly through the legislative process. I certainly recognize the issues in the balance between civil liberties versus the potential state powers in this bill during a public health emergency. And I look forward to an open debate. It's not something that I think in any way should be pushed through quickly. I respect and recognize the issues that are being brought up, but I think it's very important on everybody's part to be well prepared for potential situations, not only well prepared on supplies and stockpiling of medications and planning, but also well prepared by having the proper public health framework in place. Let me also say on the issue of vaccines, I also think that that's very important. Whether it's an AIDS patient or other immunocompromised patients, it is important that we develop a better vaccine and have more vaccine available as quickly as we can. But it's also very important to understand that the smallpox vaccine we have is by far and away safer than the situation where someone instead would contact the disease. There is just no comparison, and as Dr. Gostin said, they can't be said in the same breath. The potential of death in a normal population is somewhere between 1 and 10 people from the vaccine out of a million doses. In contrast, we would be talking about 30% of the people dying from a smallpox infection.
I want to get George Annis's response as well as Dr. Gostin, but we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll be back. Keith Richmond is Republican California State Assemblyman working to adapt the CDC proposed legislation for California. Lawrence Gostin is with us, professor of law at Georgetown University. He is the author of the CDC legislation. We're joined on the telephone also by George Annis, who's at Boston University School of Public Health, and Tanya Ehrman with AIDS Action. And we are going to continue this discussion in just a minute.
Oh, the trouble with the truth is it's always the same old thing. So hard to forget, so impossible for me to change. And every time I'll be left to blame. Oh, the trouble.
The Trouble with the Truth, Patti Loveless, here on Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be looking at women's involvement and the reconstruction of a new government of Afghanistan. And we'll also be hearing from a Palestinian-American professor talking about here and there reflections of a Palestinian diaspora. But right now, we're talking about the legislation that has just been made public by the Centers for Disease Control, proposed legislation known as the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. It was the CDC commissioned Georgetown Law Professor Lawrence Gostin to write the act at the height of the anthrax scare, and then rushed it to state legislatures as soon as it was complete. According to the Washington Post, some variation of the measure is expected to be considered in virtually every state in the coming year. It's a front page story of the Washington Post today, beginning, if bioterrorists attack the United States with smallpox virus, health authorities could impose measures as drastic as banning public events, halting regional transport, and placing entire cities under quarantine. The plan by the CDC calls for stepped-up awareness by doctors, health officials, public, to be able to detect any outbreak of smallpox, a disease officially eradicated from the planet 21 years ago, and to be able to respond quickly enough to stop it before a pandemic can sweep the nation. We're joined by Lawrence Gostin, who wrote the legislation, Keith Richman, who is working on the plan for California, Tanya Ehrman of AIDS Action, and George Annis, who is chair of the Health Law Department at Boston University School of Public Health. I'd like to go a little further into what it would mean to shore up the public health system in this country. For years, people have not particularly cared about it. Most policymakers do not address this as an issue. Sort of public health is equated with health for the poor, except at a time like this. George Annis, you heard Dr. Richman, the California State Assemblyman, saying you're talking about smallpox that could kill 30% of the people. So you have to change your whole approach. And it does involve treating, I suppose, people like the enemy to save them. What is your response?
Well, first of all, I think it's extraordinarily short-sighted to do this disease by disease. I mean, Ken Allaback, for example, who's the Russian defector, who's probably the world's expert on bioterrorism, thinks that there are at least 52 existing pathogens that can be used in a, successfully in an attack, and that people who want to attack us with bioterrorism could use any of these. And if you're just geared up for one, it doesn't do anything for the other 51. And it does, so that, I think, is extraordinarily short-sighted. The most important point to make, and the one that I think has not been well understood by the public health community, is that bioterrorism has radically changed the nature of public health. Up until 2 months ago, public health was universally seen as a local and state problem. In fact, under the Constitution, the states have the police powers, the health and safety powers, that make them the ultimate arbiters of public health. That is no longer true. In a bioterrorism attack, that is a national issue. Under the national security powers, the defense powers, it will be the federal government who has to respond. The federal FBI will be called in. If it's a crime, the military will be called in. If it's an actual attack by another government, this is no longer a state and local issue. Yes, they'll be the first responders, but the idea that they can somehow avert a national, a national epidemic when bioterrorists attack, that you have to worry about what the individual states are going to do, other than being first responders and calling the military and the FBI and the CDC, is, I think, absurd. The world has changed, and public health, I think some public health people have recognized it, but obviously some people have not.
So where do you take this, then? I mean,
where do you take it that this is a federal issue, that really the Kennedy-Frist bill you have to do, you need a – no state's going to develop new vaccines. No state is going to develop new treatments. No state is going to work out an emergency plan. That's why it was the CDC. It wasn't the state of California that came out with this plan today for how to deal with smallpox. It was the CDC. This is a federal issue. And I think that, you know, we could spend time. I'm happy to debate this issue state by state. But the individual states are not going to solve the problem of bioterrorism. That's not where the problem is. And it's not a legal problem. You can pass all the laws you want. And Congress and the states love to pass laws because it's free. They don't have to spend any money. But to rebuild the public health infrastructure, you're going to have to spend a lot of money. And it's going to be federal money, not state money.
And that money should go to what?
That money should go to building the infrastructure, putting in the monitoring systems, making sure all the departments of public health all have access to what's going on in terms of what drugs are being dispensed at pharmacies, what diseases are being found in emergency rooms, to training the first responders, training the people in emergency rooms, the physicians and nurses, training the fire department and the police department and the public health people as how to respond. But mostly that response is going to be to call the feds, to call the feds in and get this thing under control.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lawrence Gostin, you talked about intent being different than what you're hearing, the criticism of how it could play out. But you're talking right now about the Bush administration. You're talking, for example, about a Justice Department that is talking about military tribunals, perhaps even torture, about detaining people, not giving out their names. So does your original intent really matter here?
Yes, I think that intent and language does matter. Whether or not one agrees with military tribunals really isn't the issue with the Emergency Health Powers Act. One of the reasons that, in fact, perhaps the most important reason that I agreed to have my center do this bill was because I wanted to make sure that it had proper respect for persons and treated all groups with integrity and decency. And so the law throughout is very attentive to issues of procedural due process and justice and equal protection and fairness. So that is very important to me because, as you said, and all the guests have said so rightly, that we do face, you know, delicate balances and trade-offs between individual rights and public goods. I think that public health and safety has been undervalued, and we need to value it more in our laws and policies. And as George rightly said, absolutely, in terms of the kinds of money and investment we need to make in public health, that is more critical than the law. But the law is also important, and I think that this bill is not perfect, but it can be made much better, and we can and should modernize our laws. We haven't done that in the public health system for 100 years, and it's time that we all kind of came together and worked on this as a community. I might also just mention one other thing about the federal-state issue, if I could. Of course, it's correct to say that the federal government plays a large role, but it's equally correct to say that the states and localities are very important to this. And what we need is not to set up a distinction or a distraction between federal and state and local. We need to actually have them work as partners. And that's extremely important in any forthcoming epidemic.
Do you see universal health care as a part of this whole issue?
Well, I would love to see it personally, and I'm sure all the guests would. It hasn't been brought up on the table, but if you think about bioterrorism, for example, if somebody goes into the emergency room or to their doctor with an exotic or strange illness, the last thing in the world we want to happen is to have the doctor say, well, how are you going to pay for this? So we should not ask that question. Universal health care is extremely important to America. It was before September 11th. It's even more so now.
Keith Richmond, you're of the party, not that the Democrats don't side with you, but has not supported universal health care.
Well, let me say that I proposed the most sweeping comprehensive bill to cover the uninsured in the state of California in this past year. And I do believe that it's very important that not only people are covered in a health plan, but that our health care infrastructure has been terribly underinvested for years. And not only am I concerned about our ability to handle a bioterrorist attack, but here in California, we have a tough enough time handling a bad flu epidemic. Let me follow up on a couple of the other comments made by Dr. Gostin and Annis, if I could. I also believe it's very important that state and local municipalities are able to respond quickly to a public health emergency. There is no question that within the first 24 or 48 hours, the response is going to be at the local and state levels, not at the federal level.
Then I just want to add this before we have to leave this discussion, and that is you have, for example, the anthrax vaccine that's created by a company that was privatized from the state, run by one of the former chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crowe. It's considered extremely, it has not been approved by the FDA, seriously questionable. What Gulf War veterans have said they're very concerned caused their sickness.
Approved. It's the company that's not approved.
Right, and so you have the situation of privatization of the drugs that people would be forced to take, and serious questions about the efficacy and the safety of them.
There are, in fact, provisions in the bill regarding the safety of vaccines, and there's no question that the safety of any vaccine needs to be considered, and, in fact, the safety of any treatment or whatever we're going to do in a disease needs to be considered in contrast to what would happen otherwise. Those are the types of decisions that we routinely make in medicine and public health, and in fact need to be discussed again openly so that we're prepared for these types of situations. The bill does not only address smallpox. As Dr. Annis was saying, there are numerous other diseases, whether we're talking about plague, tularemia, brucellosis, or hemorrhagic viruses that could be potentially used, like Ebola, for bioterrorism. And the bill addresses the potential for all of these illnesses and again, sets the framework for the state, local governments to be prepared for that type of situation.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. It's a discussion we will continue to have. Dr. Keith Richmond, Republican California State Assemblyman, working to adapt the CDC proposal for California. Dr. Lawrence Gostin, professor of law at Georgetown University, who wrote the legislation that's just been put out by the Centers for Disease Control. George Annis, chair of the Health Law Department at the Boston University School of Public Health, and Tanya Ehrman, director of public policy at AIDS Action. That does it for the program. We'd like to hear your comments. You can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. We had help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendra. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting on the internet at WBIX.org and our website, democracynow.org. And you can get all links to our guests from there. Thanks to KPFA and to KFCF, to all our Pacifica affiliates airing us around the country. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, where we're housed, John Alpert and Keiko Suno, and Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We are broadcasting on WFMU in New York and Pacifica Station affiliate stations around the country. You can also hear us at Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of the Dish Network. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band and the fired, and the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.